Penguin Random House Audio presents Stay True, a memoir. This is the author, Hua Xu. For our parents and for my friends. Only the future can provide the key to the interpretation of the past, and it is only in this sense that we can speak of an ultimate objectivity in history, and it is at once the justification and the explanation of history that the past throws light on the future, and the future throws light on the past. Edward Hallett Carr, What is History? 1961. Because you're empty, and I'm empty, and you can never quarantine the past. Pavement, Gold Sounds, 1994. Back then, there was no such thing as spending too much time in the car. We would have driven anywhere, so long as we were together. I always offered my Volvo. First, it seemed like the cool, generous thing to do. Second, it ensured that everyone had to listen to my music. Nobody could cook, yet we were always piling into my station wagon for aspirational trips to the grocery store on College Avenue, the one that took about 6 songs to get to. We crossed the Bay Bridge simply to get ice cream, justifying a whole new mixtape. There was a 24-hour Kmart down 880 that we discovered one night, on the way back from giving someone a lift to the airport, the ultimate gesture of friendship. A half-hour drive just to buy notepads or underwear in the dead of night, and it was absolutely worth it. Occasionally, a stray, scratchy pop tune would catch someone's attention. What's this? I'd heard these songs hundreds of times before, but to listen to them with other people, it was what I'd been waiting for. Passengers had different personalities. Some called shotgun with a neurotic intensity, as though their entire sense of self relied on sitting up front. Sammy flicked her lighter all the time, until one afternoon when the glove compartment caught on fire. Prague always ejected my tapes and insisted on listening to the radio. Anthony, forever staring out the window. You might come no closer to touching another person than in a cramped back seat, sharing a seatbelt meant for one. I had taken my parents' fear of blind spots to heart, and my head constantly bounded from side to side, checking the various mirrors, noting cars in neighboring lanes, in between sneaking glances to see if anyone else noticed that Pavement was far superior to Pearl Jam. I was responsible for my friends' safety, and for their enrichment, too. I have a photo of Ken and Susie sitting shoulder to shoulder in the back, just as we're about to embark on a short road trip. They're chewing gum, smiling. I remember nothing about the trip, except the excitement of leaving for someplace else. Finals were over, and before we went our separate ways for summer, a bunch of us spent the night at a house a few hours away from Berkeley. The fun, minor danger of driving in a caravan, as though on a secret mission, weaving through traffic, carefully looking in the rear view to see that everyone else was still behind you, swerving from lane to lane or tailgating when we were the only cars on the road. I probably spent more time making the mixtape than it took to drive to the house and back. We wouldn't even be gone for 24 hours. But there was the novelty of sleeping bags, no homework, waking up in the morning somewhere unfamiliar and new, and that was enough. In general, I wasn't used to seeing Ken in the back seat. We spent a lot of nights driving around Berkeley, his leg propped up on the passenger side door, his eyes scanning the horizon for undiscovered coffee shops, some out-of-the-way dive bar that would become our haunt once we turned 21. He was always overdressed, a collared shirt, a polo jacket, things I would never wear. But maybe it was just that he was ready for adventure. More often than not, a song's drive to 7-Eleven for cigarettes. At that age, time moves slow. You're eager for something to happen, passing time in parking lots, hands deep in your pockets, trying to figure out where to go next. Life happened elsewhere. It was simply a matter of finding a map that led there. Or maybe, at that age, time moves fast. You're so desperate for action that you forget to remember things as they happen. A day felt like forever. A year was a geological era. The leap from sophomore to junior year of college suggested unprecedented new heights of poise and maturity. Back then, your emotions were always either very high or very low, unless you were bored, and nobody in human history had ever been this bored before. We laughed so hard, we thought we'd die. We drank so much, we learned there was a thing called alcohol poisoning. I always feared I had alcohol poisoning. We stayed up so late, possessed by delirium, that we came up with a theory of everything, only we forgot to write it down. We cycled through legendary infatuations sure to devastate us for the rest of our lives. For a while, you were convinced that you would one day write the saddest story ever. I remember listening to the Fugees. I remember the chill of the air. I remember the morning after, when everyone emerged from their own corner of the house, and Ken stepped out onto the deck holding a mug of coffee. How does he know how to make coffee? I thought to myself. I should know how to do that too. I have a photo of him still as he looks out toward the morning, clouds reflecting in his glasses. He wore glasses only on occasion, in a manner that made him seem serious, grown up, never a nerd. After breakfast, what could we have possibly eaten? We ventured out to the white sand beach, though the weather was no good. I wore a thrift polka-dot button-up with a frayed collar, a brown cardigan, and a striped yellow and black beanie. Only my taupe Vans had been manufactured in our lifetime. There's a photo where I'm squatting down like a catcher, pensively looking for seashells. Ken stands behind, leaning over me and waving gaily to the camera. He wears a flannel-lined navy blue jacket, tastefully baggy jeans, and brown boots. In another picture, he's perched coolly on a tall rock. Take one of me and Hwasin, he asks Anthony. He's affecting a debonair look, while I'm leaning next to him with a goofy smile. Back then, years passed when you wouldn't pose for a picture. You wouldn't think to take a picture at all. Cameras felt intrusive to everyday life. It was weird to walk around with one, unless you worked for the school paper, which made picture-taking seem a little less creepy. Maybe if you had a camera, you used it during those last few days of school, at parties or as people were packing up. The logic of last-minute cramming applied to the documentation of memories. If someone tried to take your picture, even if it was meant to be silly or spontaneous, you still fussed and awkwardly posed, because there was a finality to it. One or two snaps at most, any more would seem obsessive. A moment would pass, unremarked upon, until months later, when you developed photos you had taken at a concert or birthday party, a proper event worth chronicling, and you discovered some images of friends getting ready to go out, or else a slice of life candid intended to burn through the end of the roll. You'd forgotten about this. Later, when photography became ubiquitous, pictures were evidence that you existed at all, day in and day out. They registered a pattern. Looking back, you began to doubt the sequence of events. If, in the absence of proof, anything had happened at all. When my father moved to Taiwan, my family bought a pair of fax machines. In theory, this was so he could help me with my math homework. I was starting high school where everything, from what instrument I played to the well-roundedness of my transcript, suddenly seemed consequential. A few years earlier, in seventh grade, I tested just well enough to skip 2 years of math, and I was now paying for it. I'd peaked too early. In fact, I was very bad at math. Like many immigrants who prized education, my parents retained faith in the mastery of technical fields, like the sciences, where answers weren't left to interpretation. You couldn't discriminate against the right answer. But I preferred to spend my time interpreting things. Faxing was cheaper than long-distance calling, and far less pressure. There were no halting, wasteful silences. You simply dialed the recipient and fed a sheet of paper through the machine, and a facsimile printed out on the other side of the world. The time difference between Cupertino and Hsinchu was such that I could fax my father a question in the evening and expect an answer by the time I woke up. My homework requests were always marked urgent. He carefully explained the principles of geometry in the margins, apologizing if anything was rushed or unclear, as he was very busy establishing himself at his new job. I skimmed the explanations and copied down the equations and proofs. Every now and then I rewarded his quick, careful attention by interspersing the next set of math questions with a digest of American news. I told him about Magic Johnson's announcement that he was HIV positive. I narrated the events that led up to the Los Angeles riots. I kept him up to date on the fate of the Giants. I told him about cross-country practice, made honest commitments to work harder at school. I listed the new songs I liked, and he would seek them out in Taipei's cassette stalls and tell me which ones he liked too. I like the November Rain by Guns N' Roses. The Metallica is also great. I couldn't enjoy the Red Hot Chili Peppers and Pearl Jam. The old songs reinterpreted by Mariah Carey, I'll Be There, and Michael Bolton, To Love Somebody, are marvelous. The MTV's Unplug is a
sample complete. Ready to continue?